time opening.
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome back, everybody, back to Popcorn Talks Network, Anatomy of a Movie. We are here discussing Mockingjay Part 1, the Hunger Games series. Everyone's excited. Today, we have with me...
Hi, guys. It's Sarah Stratton. Glad to be back.
Hey, movie fans. Dimitri Danos here.
Excellent. And I am your host, Marissa Serafini. All right, part one.
This music is very dark.
We don't want to forget Phil.
Oh, yes. And we also have our amazing executive producer, Phil Spitek, in the booth. Hello, Phil.
Phil, are you going to be joining in?
He will be chiming in from time to time.
Awesome, awesome.
Yes. All right. Part one, Mockingjay. Obviously going to be split into two parts. What were your overall quick thoughts?
Okay, I'll start. I must say that I did not get to see Mockingjay opening weekend, so I was already getting other people's opinions before I got the chance to see it. I think one of the things about seeing movies opening weekend is that you kind of just get the fresh take. You're not influenced by other people's opinions or what the critics are saying, and you kind of get to make your own and then talk about it, which is also why I like how we do this show. We kind of wait for people to see it, and then we can discuss it with them. Mm-hmm. Right off the back, when Mockingjay came out, I was just kind of hearing slum reviews. No one seemed very happy. People were like kind of – the same comment kept coming up. I didn't really like the third book and I didn't really like this movie as much. They weren't saying it was terrible, but no one was overly thrilled. So I went in kind of being like, okay, don't expect too much. And I was really pleasantly surprised. A lot of people had been saying it was slow. Maybe it's because I do enjoy a slow movie as well. I really liked it. And on top of that, I went back and read just the first half of Mockingjay. Again, I just read up to the first half. And what I have to give them credit for is for the material that this movie was made off of. I think how they visually represented things that weren't in the book or only mentioned in the book did very well for the look of the film. I thought they made some really good choices in how they narrowed in their characters from the book's perspective. So for what they had, I feel like they made a really strong movie. Does it stack up to the other past two Hunger Games films? For me, not so much. I won't say it's not my favorite of the three that have been made, but I do think it was good. I do think that it follows the structure of the novel. I liked a lot of the underlying messages that I was getting from it, and I thought that the actress did a really good job.
Interesting. I don't know where to begin other than I've made it no secret. I hated the book Mockingjay. Hated it.
And hates a very strong movie.
It made me angry. Okay. And so much to the point that I wish that I could have done what a good friend of mine had done, and that was he hated it so much that as soon as he was done, he took it back to the bookstore and got his money back. You can't do that with an e-reader. So yeah. You can delete it, but I would still feel that I'd have wasted my money if I deleted it. So, and I just like this first book so much that I can't recommend the book series to anybody to read. That's how much I dislike it. So right off the bat, I felt that they had a Herculean task in trying to turn this book, adapting it for screen. And then they did I shouldn't say unthinkable, they did what everybody else is. They did the cash grab thing of splitting this book up in two. It felt it to me. This was a... Where there are aspects of the movie that I respected, that I liked, in all fairness. Katniss whining, which she does throughout the first half of the book, which was getting annoying to me. They really minimized that a lot. They did, for the most part, in certain aspects, they did a half-decent job. But yet, I still couldn't get over the fact that when all was said and done, I was like, this just should have been one movie. I felt like everything was a lead up to what's going to be the final film. I didn't appreciate that, and it felt bloated. It did feel long to me. And there were aspects of the filmmaking, for example, the director, I felt he felt more confident in this one. I thought that this was directed better than the previous two films. But even with that said, he relied, like, he would do something really cool, and I'd go, oh, that's a cool shot. And then he did that shot again and again, and I'm like, okay, we don't really need that. And there were things that were done efficiently and economically. I get that. But again, the two-hour runtime, and even though it was shorter than the previous two movies, I felt that it ran longer to me. It was like I was just waiting for something to happen and happen and happen, and then it happened, and then it's like, oh, wait until next year. So yeah. That was my thoughts.
I've seen this movie twice already in theaters as a general big fan of the Hunger Games series. You know, I'm going to watch every movie and enjoy some aspects of it. Will I say this particular one is my favorite? I have yet to see all of them yet. So I won't like officially say this was my least favorite. I enjoyed a lot of different elements of this, how they adapted a fairly shorter paced or a slower paced book element in that material and displaying it on screen. I feel like there were some scenes, and we'll get into it, that visually made me understand the situation better and the character emotions and what they're going through a little bit better, and just how putting them into such different situations makes me as an audience member understands, okay, this is what's happening. Also, the book Mockingjay, which I have right here in front of me, which we will reference to a lot. The book also explains the time spans very clearly. Like, a month has passed at the beginning of, from the beginning of this film, a month has passed since the catching fire. So, and then, like, throughout when Peter has been extracted, a month and a half has been passed. So, it was like, they clearly lay out the timeline.
That's interesting.
And the movie itself, when you watch the movie, it's not as clear-cut.
No.
So it doesn't bother me, though, that the timeline wasn't clear-cut.
For me, I took it as if these are picking up right where the events of Catching Fire left off. Because the book, for the most part, Catching Fire leaves on such a cliffhanger. Exactly. The book and the movie. You know, but particularly that book, when it says there's, you know, District 13, or, I mean, it leaves on such a cliffhanger that you can't wait until, like, I couldn't wait for Mockingjay to come out. And the movie ends the same way, and I just figure it picks up pretty much where it left off.
To clarify, I did read Mockingjay, but I read Mockingjay when the series came out, when it was huge, read all three books, read them all within like a week, loved them. Haven't gone back to Mockingjay since. Saw the movie this week, and then after watching, I went back and read the first half. So, which is kind of opposite of how I normally do things. I normally will, if I've already read the series, I'll reread the book before I get to go see the movie.
Sure.
It was pleasant to go back because it actually allowed me to really appreciate things that the movie had added instead of just focusing on the differences or the focusing on what they left out. Instead, it was made me very in tune to things that they just included in the film that we did not get to see or feel as a reader. And Marissa, you acknowledge, I think we're probably talking about the two same scenes, or two of the scenes included, when we went into the district where the lumberjacks climbed the trees and and attacked the peacekeepers, or when we got to actually see the dam being attacked. Both of those are mere sentences in
completely brushed over.
And the fact that they visually brought that to the screen, I did make it feel like things were happening more so than it does in the book. Like, we did get these scenes that were visually great, also that tied in Katniss's motivation. Each one really started or focused on one of her slogans, or it went, whether it was "If you burn, you burn with us,"
or the song.
But at least they were referenced. They were showing. For me, it was more about seeing the districts really empowered by what she was saying, And to the scale they did each of those scenes, I thought was done really well. I thought the tree scene was really fun to watch. I thought the dam scene looked great. Mm-hmm. And those were completely added just for the choice of this movie. So I thought those were really good, strong decisions on their part.
Yeah, and even so, because having the influence of the people from those districts really shows how great this rebellion is growing. Mm-hmm. It's like it started with literally a small spark, and now it's affecting so many people that it's a humongous mm-hmm. rebellion nationwide.
Yeah, and if they had stuck straight to the book, all we would be seeing would be 13 underground, and we'd get one scene outside. Yeah. Everything that was added of all the other districts, in addition to everything that we get to see in the film in regarding to President Snow, mm-hmm. so much of that we don't get from the book. And I think if they had just stuck with the material, it would have felt like we're in a dungeon.
Though. I mean, well mm-hmm. they couldn't, but that goes back to, had they stuck more to the book, we would have gotten just one movie. Like, they knew from the beginning mm-hmm. that they were going to cut this in two, and they knew that they had a problem. And regardless of what the director says about the, Francis Lawrence, whatever Francis Lawrence has to say about Mockingjay, saying, oh, I don't understand why people hate it. Well, because it's a bad book. Like, and I'm not alone in this. I know this for a fact. They had to. I mean, they had to change it because the first half of the book is basically Katniss in a closet whining about her position that she chose to do. Like, people seem to forget, and this is what I, like, one of the things about the Hunger Games that sort of gnaws at me is, like, she made the choice to protect her sister, and it was a noble cause, total noble cause. She, you know, she didn't want Prim going, so she gets into the Hunger Games. The nobility of all that seems to go by the wayside, and, you know, you're sparking this rebellion that, I get it, but I like the nobility of the Hunger Games in the first story and what that brought about and her survival and what that meant. The second book gets away from the nobility and it's all about the Hunger Games again. I'm glad we're out of the Hunger Games, but, you know, there are ways that this movie could have been just one movie. You could have made it a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. You could have incorporated... You didn't need to do a 2-hour movie.
I agree. I agree that this should have been one movie, but I don't know if the decision was on the studios or on the director.
Absolutely,
you know?
It was on the studios.
And so
marketing,
and that's
more.
What you're assuming. I'm assuming it's on the. Yeah,
it's more money. I mean,
but this is my point. My point is, if this is the deck of cards are held, right. Your dealt. You're told, guess what? You're taking the book that everyone loves the least, and not only do you have to make it into a movie, you have to stretch it into two.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this is your material. Good luck.
Yeah.
And guess what? You're gonna have millions of people watching it and judging it, but here, have fun. And with those cards that were dealt in that situation, I like what he did with this film.
Yeah.
Does it stack up to the other ones? I'm not going to sit here and argue, no. But I do want to argue. I do want to talk about what choices they did make and how it played out for the movie we saw.
Yeah, let's get into the directing aspect.
Sure.
Francis Lawrence, back again. He mm-hmm. did Catching Fire, and now he's doing Mockingjay Part 1 and 2. They mm-hmm. have already completed filming.
Yeah.
They're in the post-part as of right now when we're discussing this. So he's back again for this one. What did we think of his way of how he had to change some scenes now that Philip Seymour Hoffman have passed away, and they had to rework a few scenes and give some dialogue that was originally for Plutarch's character to Effie Trinket?
Yeah. Well, Effie came back not just for that. She came back, and this is like, Susan Collins has said this. She was a fan favorite, and she's not in. She's not in the book, really. Yeah, and I even forget what happens to her at the end.
She's actually a prisoner in the Capitol.
Okay,
for the
pretty
much the whole span of the book, and it's when they kill President Snow.
Well,
that they
we
really
can't
right.
listen now.
Well, we'll get into that.
I don't know if we want to get into spoilers.
I appreciate. Look, I don't mind that they bring Effie Trinket back. I think they utilized her well. I think they cut around or did with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think they did a really good job. I think Francis Lawrence as a director, I think he was more self-assured in this particular movie. He had some shots that were really beautifully shot, mm-hmm. Where he put the camera, where he actually even held his focus on. So I felt that he was a more confident director this go-around. So he, you know, I think, into your point, they had to do something. And, you know, I think they did, with the material that they had and they had to rewrite, you know, he did a he's a very capable job giving. And he did it in, he did certain scenes in a very efficient and economical way. And we'll talk about, I guess, some of our favorite scenes, like you had mentioned the tree scene. But I had another scene that I liked. But what was interesting to me is, I felt that I could tell, I was wondering where they chose to throw money at and where they didn't throw money at. And to me, it was obvious. And it was like, oh, okay, obviously you're going for efficiency here, but you're going to try to throw money at this, but yet you're not going to give me a payoff.
Which specific scenes are you talking
about? Okay, for me, again, one of my favorite scenes was the bombing of Capitol 13, or District 13, I'm sorry. Now,
when they're in the...
when they're in the bunkers. Air raid. Yeah, and it's the air raid. Now, I liken this to back in the day in TV, and they still do it today for economic reasons, but Star Trek was famous for this. They would do what they call a bottle episode. This meaning they would film an entire episode on the ship because it saved money. They didn't have to build sets for a new planet for them to go to and special effects.
Yeah, one location type.
One location kind of a thing. That's what this reminded me of, because if you remember, we never go outside. And basically all it is, it's the control room. It's like inside the bunkers, the bedrooms. And it's basically shaking the camera a little bit, having people go like this, some dust falling from the ceiling, putting the camera in some decent angles. And then in the control room, you have a big radar that has red. And red's never good, unless it's a Ferrari or the woman in red. And it was done. It got the effect. It
needed.
Translated what you got, and you had great sound effects too. Mm-hmm.
What I also give that scene, which you were completely correct on how they did film it, but they also enhanced the scene by starting the bombing earlier than it starts in the books. Because in the books, everyone's completely safe and secure and toying around in their new confines, and then we start getting the shaking. That they did propel that faster, that we got really straight into action with this scene, that people weren't just in the book, it's like they calmly get to the place. Yeah. They get to look around and look at their toothbrushes.
And they get to read their schedule and all
that. And then they vomit. Instead, they enhanced this. They put it forward in motion to the point that people were running downstairs. They made everything, they just raised the stakes a little bit, still with the same effect, no long change and an alteration in plot, but just by speeding up that attack a little bit, I think that they did heighten that scene for the movie. And you're right, it was an economical.
Well, it was economical because there were no special effects, really. Like, not to take
practical effects. We had a bunch of water, which that was not in the book too. When Katniss is going after her sister, it's like, okay, oh, there you are. She hardly had to walk five steps, and then there was her sister, instead of like going through the doors and running up the stairs and drenching water, and then like, okay, now we're gonna get locked out. They, like you said, Sarah, they really enhanced it.
Yeah, and there was no exterior shot. There was we never saw any of the strafing or the carpet bombing that was going on.
It was the sound effects.
And it was good sound effects. There was some decent dialogue between President Coin and Plutarch there in the control room. So I thought that scene was fine. But then another scene where they appeared to throw a lot of money at was the rescue attempt. Well, not the attempt. They actually rescued.
Extraction.
Well, we never see the extraction. We never see the payoff to what they're doing. So it was like, okay, I'm going to show these great rappelling scenes because they're coming down, and that was really cool, right? I mean, that was
a cool
scene.
Cool location, white room lights going through.
Right,
everywhere.
And it wasn't smoking visualized everywhere in the book because, again, Katniss was in the bunker. Yep. She was still in. So the mere fact that we're sort of getting to see this was great, but we never see the extraction. All we hear about is, well, they let us go too easy. Like, everything was back up and running again. And so it was like, well, you're showing me, but you're not showing me actually.
The only reason I think is because they want to keep PETA from you till the very end.
But that wouldn't have mattered because he wouldn't have gone nuts until he saw Katniss anyways. Mm-hmm. So it really wouldn't have mattered. So, like, we don't see them extracting anybody. We just hear, like Katniss, we hear about it. But that they did it, even though they spent this great shot, like a James Bond movie almost.
I loved the rappelling. I liked also how they included the volunteers for the mission's faces on the screen on the side while she's simultaneously watching the broadcast, and that she's there for that. I did like that. For me, I didn't need to see them get back into the plane as much. As if, for me, there was just certain moments at the bottom of that where they were going through the corridors and, like, the white rooms and light were going on that dragged a little bit. I liked the repelling. I liked, but, like, every time that they would throw something in to, like, gas it, I wasn't actually that interested.
But would you agree that a good part of that movie, the good part of the movie was talking about this rescue attempt, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't get to really see the rescue attempt and see if they had any. We know that things are going awry, and they built that up too with editing, going back and forth because everything was coming back online. So they were building the suspense there, but what other problems did they get any resistance? Was there, like, they didn't pay off this rescue attempt that the whole movie was actually sort of kind of gearing to. Once she brought the demands up, we got to get these people out and do all that stuff. So it was just interesting to me.
I felt there was somewhat of a payoff because we, as the audience, we did get to see PETA. We did get to see Joanna at the end. So it was like they went and they did have a fairly successful extraction. And the fact that, you know, the whole editing and the juxtaposition of the whole broadcast, which I actually loved how they added more to the broadcast, because in the book, they're just talking about it.
Right.
And they're like, let's give the President Snow something to distract him so he wouldn't pay attention. But the fact that this movie, they added more that we're also simultaneously jamming their frequencies so they won't know that we're coming in.
Right.
They added a little bit more to the whole importance of the extraction too, which I thought was very well done.
We did start on this conversation, which we've expanded into a whole nother area, but I wanted to go back further a little bit how it started with Effie Trinket, because I did have something to say about her. I think that
she's one of the biggest changes
in this movie, and I really have to applaud them on it because I think it worked wonderfully. I do not think that I want to try and say this as gracefully as possible, which is probably going to be hard. Philip Seymour Hoffman had some really great scenes, and how they filled it in, I didn't feel like I was missing huge chunks of dialogue from him. Yes, there was awareness that I was, and that made me sad, but it wasn't, to me, it didn't feel like it really hurt the movie because they added her in such a strategic way. And not only did they just add her for fluff, I think she was a fan favorite, so she really brought that to well. Also, her performance is great. It's very, like, emotionally charged. And how they focused in the book, Katniss has her prep team with her.
We did not see the prep team
at all. Pretty much all of their lines were given to Effie. Even some of Finnick's lines were given to Effie. Mm-hmm. And I thought she pulled them off really well. I also think, in general, it was a better decision. I don't think any of us really missed the prep team or really connected with them in the first movie. So to bring her in, to kind of channel all that energy into a person that I really, really adore in this film and I think does a really strong job, I thought all of her scenes fit perfectly, and there was never a moment where I was like, I wish she wasn't there and the prep team was. I thought that she just really carried out every moment really well.
I completely agree, because Effie, like you said, fan favorite, and she brings so much levity to their situation right now. And PETA going through torture, like, the whole Mockingjay and Capitol is being bombed or whatever. She brings a lot of levity to their serious situation. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, she's fun and she's very more humbled now in the fact that she misses coffee, which was actually Plutarch's line. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, like, it made sense also for what they gave her, more material to work with. It still made sense with her character, because when she's giving the Mockingjay costume designs from Cinna to Katniss, that was actually Plutarch's, and that was a scene that wasn't filmed yet with Philip Seymour Hoffman. So, but it would make sense for her character, because Effie would be more inclined to know what Cinna was up to and be with.
Right.
Know what, you know, the prep team would be other than Plutarch.
I just feel like they really did narrow in the focus on certain characters in this, which I felt worked for the movie really strongly. I liked that it was Plutarch, Effie, Katniss, Gale. You got a little bit of her, like, new film crew, but it wasn't too much. I did like that they focused in. I was a little worried for a split second that they were going to create, like, a love triangle between Gale and Shaved Head,
mm-hmm.
who Game of Thrones. There we go.
Cressida. Yeah.
Cressida. Thank you. Director. Like, I kind of thought they were going to start making a little love triangle there for a split second. Mm-hmm. Don't ask. It went in my mind. And I was like, no, don't make this any more complicated than it needs to be. So I did. I liked that the plots were very, like, to me, focused. There wasn't a lot of drama between all the sub-characters or anything like that.
No, I had no problem with Effie Trinket being in there, and it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. You know, all things considered. Number one, it is economical, number one, because now, instead of three actors, all you need is the one. And the one, and it makes sense that it would be Effie. Mm-hmm. And she is, you know, that character cinematically has become more of a fan favorite than I would say that character ever was in the mm-hmm. books. I had no problem with that at all. It made for a better plotting. To be quite honest, I did forget what happened to her in Mockingjay anyways. But She factored so little in that. So making her a presence because... she was a presence. She was such a presence in the in Hunger Games and then in Catching Fire. Mm-hmm. She had some great scenes, so it makes sense. And, you know, that is one of those things, like I said, that I get why they did it. Still could have made her into one movie.
Yeah.
But it makes complete sense, and she was great, again, you know, playing mm-hmm. that role.
Always. She was really nice.
We're starting to get into the cast and whatnot. So we talked a good deal about Effie, but what about everyone else that's...
Elizabeth Banks.
Give her credit. Amazing.
Elizabeth Banks is really good.
And a lot of her Effie's lines were actually because it was new material, she improvised a lot of her lines, which was cool. What do we think of let's start with the directorial team that for the propos, you know, Cressida, Pollock, and
I think functionally they all did really well. Like
the side characters.
No, you're right. I mean, it's a perfect enough. Yeah. Like almost anybody could have been there.
Exactly.
But you're right.
Like I wasn't kind of like I understood what each of them did.
Right.
You know, Cressida at certain times she had to walk a very fine line from being like wanting to be on her side and being obnoxiously annoying, because for me it's kind of it's a very hard thing to be on your side when like someone's about to cry and then someone's sitting on the sidelines being like talk about your feelings. Like if that were me in real life, I'd probably throw something at them, like tell me.
You know what? And that's, can we get to that, because you brought up that's a great point. I felt, when the hell is Katniss gonna fucking shoot her in the face with an arrow, because like that, what, again, to me that sort of kind of not derails when I think of the right word, it sort of takes away from Katniss, because Katniss is like, number one, she didn't really, in the book, she doesn't want to do any of this,
mm-hmm.
and then when they're making the movie, right, it sucked.
Onset.
Like the promo thing, it was like a joke, mm-hmm. right, but I found even what they filmed was still like cheesy, can't be, whatever. And if I had somebody, like, I'm surprised Katniss didn't lay her out a couple times. That's not because of Natalie Dormer's performance. I think it was
Scenario. It's just a scenario, and it is brought up in the books as well, where like you have Katniss in kind of an emotional state, and she kind of needs that person to like draw it out of her. But
look at the camera.
It is strange, because I feel like in real life, if someone ever does that when you were that affected, you wouldn't respond well.
No.
You wouldn't be like, yes, you're right, channel this. But that is the essence of this movie. That is the essence of what she is about. So I get it. And Natalie Dormer did a fine job of walking that line and not being too...
Exactly. And I don't mean that insulting Natalie Dormer, because I think you're a decent presence.
I'm sure she's a great actress. I mean,
absolutely.
She's very well known from
Wonderful.
Game of Thrones.
No, she is,
I haven't seen her in anything.
Mm-hmm. She was
other
in
than,
The Counselor for a little
and
bit.
Other
and
than
she's
this
also in
particular
Captain
film.
America.
She has a great career.
Also, one of my favorite of that crew was, and also for functional purposes, but he did it endearingly, was the AVOX.
Mm-hmm.
Pollux. You know, he obviously didn't have much to say, but
Elvin
at least
Henson.
He felt very sweet. I understood why she wanted to. I liked that they gave him the whistle to the birds. Mm-hmm. They shortened that down. That made that seem very concise, straight from him whistling to her being able to sing. Also thought that was a really I thought she sang the song beautifully. A lot of people have been talking about it. Loved the tone they gave it, and like that they spread to the next scene, and then also evolved it to almost like a choral singing in the background. It yes. went from like, I liked the evolution of the song film-wise, because it went from her direct singing and we're focused on Jennifer Lawrence singing, to the fact that the song actually is a very good song. Then you get another piece. I like it. I like it.
I like how it evolved.
It went from her singing to the crowd singing, and then it kind of disappears into the soundtrack and becomes kind of like a rebellion. It gets into where it's almost like a choir singing it above, and there's a different tone to it. It sounds very churchy.
Gospel.
Yeah, gospel.
I felt it turned very gospel, which I didn't mind.
Actually. I liked the evolution of it. It went from very like bluesy and went all the way through.
That was my Magnolia moment, and I'm referring to the movie Magnolia, where I forget what the hell. There's a scene where somebody starts singing a song, mm-hmm. and then they cut to other people who have no relation to that person, and they're doing something completely else. And they're all singing the same song, and that moment I was just like, oh, come on, I get it. Now you're beating me. Like, I just felt...
Oh, see, and I liked it. Maybe it was because I really, really liked the song, so yeah. I already wanted to be singing it.
And even the song itself is very dark.
Yes.
Very dark. But to use such a simple song about relationship gone awry and their situation...
to say the least.
To be used for a rebellion into... join forces to stand up against the Capitol. Mm-hmm. I really liked how they added to that.
I want to hang myself in a tree so I can be with you forever.
Well, it's reflective of these whole things where from the very beginning of this film, they're talking about like how, you know, they're all kind of going to wind up dead and how at certain points they almost like that idea.
Well, we won't talk spoilers.
I mean, but they do. They like between Finnick, between... Katniss in the book and in the film, it's constantly like this battle of what's worse, death, which could be freedom, or the life they're living, which is torture. Mm-hmm. And this song is very reflective of that, where it depends on who the song takes on a meaning from you're looking from the outside in to the singer becoming the person in the hanging tree. So to me, it's very reflective of the whole film. And I think it's very good.
It shows like what would someone do for freedom? In your definition,
or
if
that, yeah, exactly, and it's well, it's.
I will just go to the New Hampshire license plate motto: "Live free or die." That sums it up in one sentence. On a license plate.
A little bit more about the technical aspects of this particular scene with Jennifer singing. Mm-hmm. Francis Lawrence kind of actually had a hard time having Jen sing because Jen she doesn't really like I say Jen like I know her Jennifer she really doesn't prefer her own voice and she didn't want to sing, but you know it's her job and she had to, and she sang for a good few hours. She sang the whole song all day long in front of 150 people, but. What I liked about what Francis Lawrence said about this shooting this, that from the story-making element, it's really not... It's not supposed to sound professional, like a professional singer saying it. It's supposed to sound like a little girl singing something really true and genuine. And then the fact that Jennifer Lawrence has a really raspy texture to her voice just made it all the more real.
Yeah. And I know that this is the one scene she said while filming was that where she cried. It was the only time she ever cried while making the movie because she didn't want to sing that badly.
That's how much she didn't want to do it.
Yeah, that's how much she didn't want to do it. And I agree with you. I felt her voice... with the way that they did the cadence to this gospelish kind of song, I thought her voice was fine. But again, when you say a little girl, that's the thing. I don't look at Jennifer Lawrence as a little girl.
I don't either
because she's not. She's Katniss in the book right now is only 17.
She's Jennifer Lawrence 16. Yeah,
Jennifer Lawrence was like 23 while filming this.
Yeah.
So, a bit older than what the average person
should
be. The thing
is, I actually like the age change in this. I like the feeling of her being a little older because, for me, Prim represents kind of the, like, 14-year-old age right now. So, I like that there is a bigger gap that I don't feel like she's such a teenager, though I do feel like she's more of a young adult.
Yeah, so, and on me with that, had you gone younger... Part of what made Katniss in the first book, one of her strengths was the fact that she looked very unassuming. Like, people didn't look at her as a threat, but we as the audience, through Suzanne's writing, knew that, you know, dude, she could take you out. Like, you know, even though she may look 15 and she may look demure and skinny, but she's tough and she'll take you out. And that was her, like, her strength that Katniss played on. Look, I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is Jennifer Lawrence. Personally, it's hard for me to see her in this movie because since the first Hunger Games, when you see her in a Silver Linings Playbook and, you know, an American Hustle, and we know that this girl can act. And this, to me, for her, this is going to be the thing that this is her retirement. This is, if she ever has a family, this is for her kids' college fund. I get it. Like, she's like, the money, like, this is the good paycheck for her. She's doing a good job, but it's hard, like, seeing she's such a good actress. I think she's a really talented, strong person on screen. And I think she's well beyond her years, actually, in certain movies. Like, I watch her and I'm going, I can't believe this is a 24-year-old. But then I see Mockingjay and I was like, yeah, she's so much. I've seen her in Silver Linings Playbook.
See, but that's fine with me. I like that she can kind of, you know, deal with all sorts of genres. And I do think she does that this role very well. Also, the fact that she does give it emotional depth works for me. It's not just surface level with her. She does really, I think she takes her job seriously.
Oh, she does.
And the fact that she is represented as being a little bit older and not a 16-year-old that we can imagine in the books, it makes the love story or the draw between PETA and Gale more strong for me.
Yeah.
And more real than if you had, someone who really seemed to be 16 fighting between the two. I believe it more with her seeming older.
I think Chloe Moretz would have been able to handle the job pretty well, too. Again, nothing against Jennifer Lawrence. I was just, she's a very fine actress, and she's going to continue to go on, and who knows what other nominations she'll get in her career. But I don't think it'll be for Hunger Games.
No, I don't think it's that many movies. But, I mean, she has a strong cast supporting her.
Absolutely.
Donald Sutherland, who has praised Jennifer Lawrence for her work. He always does he didn't have a whole bunch of time in this movie, and I thought he always does a good job. Julianne Moore. The new big dog to talk about, I think, in this film as our another president.
All right. Now, both of you have read the book.
Yeah, absolutely.
My question to you, do you think Julianne Moore was a great, excellent choice for President Snow and how they portrayed her in the film?
For President Coyne? I think the rewriting of her character and the way that Julianne Moore portrayed President Coyne, again, was sort of kind of a smart decision because, again, we're stretching this out into two movies. Mm-hmm. So, by, in a sense, what's the best way to put, softening her? Sort of kind of in
subduing
a way. Yeah.
A little bit.
I mean, they're holding back. Mm-hmm. Because we've read the books, we know what this character is sort of kind of all about. And the way that it was written, the way that Julianne Moore is playing her, and I think that has a lot to do with the directing, I think it's a smart way to go because you're stretching it out in two movies. So you don't want to give away your hand on this character.
In the first movie, yeah.
Right at the get-go. And it was a good sort of kind of progression.
What I'll say with her is I think that Julianne Moore is a fabulous actress who does a fantastic job. I think that she seems calculative and smart, and you understand that she's strategically very powerful. The only qualm I would have with her in this role is there was one instance that stuck out to me where she's motivating or addressing everyone in 13, and it's right before their war cry, and she sticks a fist in the air, and I couldn't help but be like, Julianne Moore's so tiny. She's such like a little, like she, you know, she's commanding this whole place of warrior citizens, and she's like, has her fist in the air, and it's like, yay! And everyone's like, hoorah! And I was like, okay, that seems a little much, but I get that she's at least very, very smart, and she has the mindset to be able to think quickly, keep her calm, and have a plan, and she does embody those characteristics very well. The other thing that I thought that District 13 and Julianne Moore's command illustrated in this film was how Jennifer Lawrence is still a pawn in two societies, which who knows which one's actually better than the other, because both of them have their own agendas. Both of them are using her and have bad sides and good sides.
Yeah, but I don't think in regards to this movie that has necessarily been played out through President Coyne just yet. I think they've kept the cards a little bit closer to the vest this time.
Yeah.
Because in the book, as a reader, we see that very early on. Mm-hmm. She's using Katniss just as much as, like, they're almost like the same sides of an opposite coin, except they're actually on the same side of a two-headed coin.
Yeah.
And, like, again, like, we can't help. I gotta talk about this. That's funny. President Coyne is I didn't mean that really as a pun to her name. We know that President Coyne can be as bad as President Snow.
Yeah.
But it's not shown. That doesn't come through. Like, had you not read the books going into the movie, you wouldn't necessarily pick up on
it. I will say from part one that we've, as an audience, have already seen, she's not an intimidating person. So, and we know that she lost her family. She lost her husband and her daughter through the pox epidemic. So we know, like, she's had big history. Like, she's suffered. She's had loss. And so we, as an audience, we feel for her. And the fact that she's leading the whole Capitol 13 in certain ways and then using Katniss in certain ways, it was like, she's not intimidating yet. She hasn't really given us a reason to not like her yet.
Right. And it almost
reading
seems like
the book, we know her character and her motivation. Right now, she's like, okay, I'm just going to use you, Katniss, to start this revolution.
And she's not so, in the way that it's played, too, at least the way I saw the performance, like, she wasn't so self-assured until the end of this movie, until the end of part one. She seemed to gain a little bit more and more confidence, but she seemed to heavily rely on Plutarch up until one scene where she sort of kind of
Dismisses him.
Yeah.
Feeling, okay, you know what, I can do this. I'm getting the hang of this. But I think they purposely softened the character a bit so that we can get...
So she has a bigger twist in the end.
I think so. I mean, well, yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they're going to change that character. It's like that...
As book readers,
right.
Let's not get into that.
And President Snow, Donald Sutherland.
We'll try to avoid as many spoilers as
we can. And President Snow, as you said, Donald Sutherland, you know, he was in this, he was highly effective. You know, he seems to relish this role. Like, he seems to really enjoy.
Cold.
Yeah, but he seems to have fun doing this role. And, you know, I think he was just happy that he was asked. And, yeah, and he's part of it. And the mere fact that the gentleman is still acting and with us today, I think is fantastic. So he's having a good time playing this, and he's menacing and evil and, you know.
We know from the book, but this film has a lot of exposition with his character and his backstory. We get a deeper understanding of him and the meaning of all the white roses and then poison.
Yeah, and let me ask you this, because to me, that was such a throwaway, because they did it in a sense where other things were going on.
Exactly.
I think the fans had an outcry from, like, the first Hunger Games movie, because if you're a reader of the books, like, it was explained early on about this and spitting blood and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was never addressed, really, in the movies. Like, it was never
there
really...
were little hints here and there, and I will mention two specific ones in Catching Fire. When PETA and Katniss are at the end of their tour, and they're at the big fancy dinner, and they're dancing and whatnot, there's a shot of President Snow. He's drinking his wine or champagne, and there's blood coming out.
Right.
There's one.
It's when the fireworks are showing.
Yes, when the fireworks. Right. Exactly. And then the second one is when Finnick is actually talking to Katniss for the very first time before they enter the opening ceremony, Finnick said he learned a lot in payment, winning the games, from secrets. And then they also brought it back to Mockingjay. And then when the whole broadcast was going on, he's like, secrets about President Snow. I know them all.
Right. Now,
so they did come full circle with the secrets.
Yeah. And in the books, though, we were let in and like it was like one of those weird things that was never really explained until this movie. And to me, like that scene that they were doing, because it was the rescue scene, so we had rappelling going on, then we had we had Finnick going on, and then we had, there was a lot going on in
there
that
was
scene.
So
if you weren't paying attention to Finnick, you would have missed it all.
And that's also part of the reason earlier I mentioned that in the rescue scene, when they're down throwing the gas, those scenes felt long to me because I wanted to get back because I knew Finnick was saying things that I wanted to hear. And so I was fine with the rappelling, like that felt good. Uh-huh. But then we started to get Finnick talking, and then they kept going to these gas, like them throwing in gas bombs. And I was like, no, I don't want to see this. This isn't really doing much. Go back. I want to hear Finnick.
And that's where audio editing can come into play when, like, that's the sound of opening door and hearing the gas expelled. That's something the audience doesn't need to listen to. They could play Finnick's voiceover on top of that.
That would have worked so much better.
I feel like the juxtapositions of a very important exposition scene on top of an extraction scene didn't really work the way that they executed it as well as they could
have. It was just interesting how it was it just seemed like a throwaway. We have it in here, and this is like
that
important
wasn't a
exposition. Yeah, and it just seemed like it was important exposition for the fans of the book who were waiting for this exposition to come out, because it was, and I grant it was hinted that something was up, but we never knew. As book readers, we do know, and I think fans of the book were saying stuff, and finally they're getting their exposition, and it's muddled up with this extraction going on, and I thought it was a well edited scene as far as pacing. It just seemed that one explanation just seemed to be thrown away needlessly, because it's sort of important to know, because it comes back at the
but
also that this particular scene was a scene that really helps Finnick add more to it. This was a big scene for his character too.
Yeah.
He's the one with all the secrets on President Snow out of everybody, which is very important, and this could be a turning point, and it didn't feel like it in the movie.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, I know this about him.
Well, we also never were getting any of the Capitol's reactions, which I think could have been important here. Like, we know they were nice enough to let us see the other districts' reactions with scenes of rebellion. But finally, when we break through the Capitol, we do get the only person's reaction we're getting is a little bit of PETA's. Mm-hmm. And we don't get anyone else's in the Capitol's, which I think would have been, for me, interesting to see. They did open up the option with this film of letting us into other views other than Katniss through other scenes. So I was kind of hoping that we would also get to see some of the Capitol's reactions. And they also made PETA's reaction a lot less violent than it is in the books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that would have been, I was a little confused why they did edit out. In the books, PETA gives them the warning that they're going to be attacked, which is promptly answered with a camera being hitting the ground and the sound of some sort of punch or kick and blood being splattered in front of the screen, which is a very powerful image. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that would maybe have, I don't think that could have changed the rating. I think it's all the same. They just decided to pass that out and it goes black. And so we don't get that very powerful image that affects Katniss a lot in the film, of the blood, of the torture he has had to endure when he gave up this information. Right. So I was a little, I found that interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't include that.
I understand that, but that also, that was the starting point of an action scene. The quick cut is like, oh, what's happening now? Then everyone automatically goes into a frenzy when they cut
and
the
then
transition.
They do rush straight
into. So literally, I can understand why they cut it, only just to start something else, really.
Because they did hasten that next scene so quickly, the bombing.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's probably the filmmaking standpoint. That was probably the only reason why they cut that.
Sure.
And you mentioned that might have changed the PG-13 rating. I don't think so. With the violence, I mean, what I thought there was
a
picture
of dead bodies and skulls.
I know.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I actually thought that there was.
That would have really, because that was very visually graphic for me, seeing all those skeletons, and that's like borderline rated R, PG-13.
It took me right back to Terminator and Terminator 2. But in any case, I felt that Mockingjay, as a book, was by far the most violent in the series. Like, violent to the point that it was turning me off. I mean, like, I was I was going, this is a teen book? Like, I could not believe the violence showcased.
Harry Potter gets very violent,
too. Oh, Jesus. So. People do not die in the ways that they die that second half of Mockingjay. I mean, it is pretty violent. And she's Stephen King's people. And by Stephen King, if you've read, like, you read a Stephen King novel, the first rule of thumb is don't get attached to anybody because he's Stephen King. And I was very shocked. So this movie, I felt, was probably the most violent, even though we've had The Hunger Games and it's kids on kids. But it was like the tree scene, you know, with the lager scene. You said the, you know, with the skulls and the bodies everywhere. Although I did the hospital scene, I thought, in the book was pretty violent. They seemed to almost tone that down a little, actually.
I felt the hospital scene was very toned down.
Yeah.
Because we hear it, we know that it happened in the distance, and then we see the end result of it, just burning. I mean, had they added something as simple as people screaming and them literally burning to death, that would have made it way more violent, way more graphic. And I'm glad that we didn't get that. We just saw the result of the bombing of
the hospital. Yeah, because that was a very violent scene, part in the book.
Yeah, we killed hundreds of innocent men, women, and children.
So, you know, it's just interesting. I felt, like I said, I did feel, even with the movies preceding it, I felt that going into this, that this was probably the most violent, being that we're about to go into war.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, more violent, but less action in this, in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, we see the end results of things, because obviously we're leading into the second film, which will have a lot more stuff going on.
But there was another scene. There were other scenes that weren't in the book outside of just mere mention, like a sentence throwaway. And that was, and this is another scene that I liked the first time that it was used. And that is when they were going to the other districts. You'll have to help me because I do forget which particular district this was, but it's when the Capitol security team brought those people up on the stage blindfolded and tied, and then they shot
all
them.
The districts.
Okay. Well,
During the broadcast, yeah, President Snow,
correct,
as he's speaking to them,
right,
he uses people as examples and then executes them in front of each respective district.
The one particular shot that I'm referring to is the shot where it's seen in the reflection of the security person's mask, so to speak. And I was like, oh, that's a clever shot. It's going to mask the violence to an extent because we're seeing it in a dark reflection.
In a second hand.
You know, and it's, but, you know, it was well done. But then they repeated the technique a couple of other times after. And I'm like, okay. It was really cool and effective the first time you did it. And then you had to rely on it a lot to do it again. There was at least one or two other times that they
Yeah, and there's only
the
so many ways you can show shooting someone from behind.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly. But I agree that they did, because there is a lot of death, that the killing these innocent people can't always be focused upon because there's so much more going on.
Yeah, and again, it was mentioned in the book. I mean, because the book is very... The first half of the book is so internal that they had to find ways to make it external and a little more visceral.
I feel like the first half... first half of the book is more reactionary compared to anything really going on.
Sure.
It's always getting the reactions of something already happened, and then we're getting the end result of it. We talked a little bit about the action scenes, but what do we think of the overall pacing of the film? For it being a shorter film out of the franchise so far, but in less action, some here, what do we think of the general pacing? Did it keep your attention?
What I have to say is that the first half of Mockingjay the book drags so much that this was like lightning speed first half of the book. Like... I mean, I don't know if that's a compliment, but it's more of a backhanded compliment.
But I know what you're saying.
I mean, that's all I can say. Like, if you compare this to all the other ones, yes, it's slower. If you're comparing this to how long the read is, they did a really good job of making it faster.
Yeah. Well,
the read? Yeah, absolutely.
The first half of the Mockingjay, the book, reads so
again,
slow.
I was just like, get the hell out of the closet, please. Get out. Stop whining, please. I felt the pacing to me was bloated. I said it from the top of the show. It felt very bloated to me. It really felt like they were throwing in filler, and it really felt like a setup. Like, it didn't feel like a complete movie, period. And, you know, I take umbrage with some of the reviews, the early reviews that they were posting, you know, mm-hmm. to get, like, the positive ones. People are saying, this is the best in the series so far. And I'm like going, no way. No. Like, there's not even close. And to your point, like, we don't, it's not done yet, but it's not even close.
But the problem is, like, you said you knew that right off the back because it's like the material wasn't there for it to be the best. You couldn't say this is going to be the best because you knew what you were in for. They mm-hmm. did a much better job than what I expected. What I will say is, yeah, it's not a complete, it doesn't feel like a complete movie. I think Francis Lawrence said that the whole point of the first half was just going to be about PETA, and the whole point of Mockingjay 2 is going to be about President Snow. And, like, that's how they had to divide it. So this is what we got.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. And also, Francis Lawrence said the first half is pretty much going off of the story-making decision that mm-hmm. Katniss is going after President Snow, her decision, and then the second half is actually going mm-hmm. for President Snow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought the first half was going for PETA.
Yeah, the first
PETA half too, but PETA, like, but it was the story making is like, okay, I decide to be your Mockingjay, and now the second half is like, okay, I am your Mockingjay, now I'm going to go after Snow.
Yeah. So it was interesting. The other person that we hadn't really talked about too, and again, he was just a throwaway in this movie, it, sadly, was Woody Harrelson's Haymitch. Mm-hmm. I mean, the character was a throwaway. I mean, so like, and again, it was done in such a way where when he first comes on and he sees Katniss throws this line out about something about sobriety, and I was like, mm-hmm. wow, that's what sobriety looks like? Because he still looked pretty drunk to me.
Yeah,
I don't know. He was...
I actually felt that they gave more to Haymitch this particular movie than they did in the book. Because he's there... The particular scene I'm talking about is when they're talking about setting up the propos, and they already filmed the first one and realized that mm-hmm. tanked. Right. They're like, okay, we need unscripted from her. Right. And then they gave that scene to Haymitch, like, okay, saving Sis, you know,
I actually really liked that scene. I thought it was hilarious. So
his character added humor to that, mm-hmm. and that wasn't in the book. They had the discussion of unscripted, we need that, right. but Haymitch was not the one leading that conversation.
Yeah. I liked the addition of that scene, that the comedy they added there. And it was coming very quickly after the comedy they added about the cat. I thought it was a funny line.
And my sister gets to keep the cat.
And it's the last line versus in the book. Yeah. It's the first one.
Uh-huh.
And it's been, like, discussed. And other people helped her come up with these.
Yeah.
And so the fact they kind of changed that through the lesson,
but
I thought
then the
was
cat also, goes through that silly cliche of, where's the cat? We got to save the cat before they shut all the doors.
That line in that particular, when she's setting down the provisions and whatnot, they kept that line, but they cut out one of the most important provisions ever, was that Katniss said, when the opportunity presents itself, I'm the one that gets the privilege to kill President Snow. They did not have that in the movie. They had that clearly in the book.
And I was wondering if that's going to be in the second part.
And like, it probably will be worked in a different way.
Yeah.
But that's when she was laying down the laws and her provisions. If I'm going to be your Mockingjay, I'm the one that gets to kill
Snow. Francis said that he didn't want that to be the focus of this film, so that's why they left it out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's very
I think that was my only problem with that scene, only because I was kind of waiting for it.
Yeah.
But I do like the adjustment that they made that moment very focused on her versus in the book. She has multiple conversations with other people, and it kind of, this list is known as, like, why. And they left out the whole Gale chunk as well, where in the original demands, Gale was demanded to be by her side, and it leads into a discussion about their relationship and mm-hmm. who he is to her. They did cut that chunk out of it, and I think it's so that people won't
root for her and Gale against Team Gale against Team PETA.
Okay.
I can understand
I actually think that Gale's like the, you know, after reading the books, and I think Gale is the strongest character throughout.
Gale got the shtick in all these movies.
Yeah, you know, he does. He does. And I agree. And it's not whether I'm team or not. I'm just talking from a story point perspective. He's the one that makes a choice. He stands by his conviction, and he stands up to fight. And he doesn't whine and complain about standing up and fighting. He's like, I'm doing this. I'm doing this for queen and country. Like, it's the right thing to do. Like, why would you not be doing this? Like, and he ends up, like, It's I don't think it's been mentioned, but I actually think that his character ends up is the strongest character for someone who's supposed to be a teenager. And I know we're seeing this through Katniss's eyes, but to me, Gale is the person that you want to like.
He's the most consistent out of all the movies. He doesn't sway either way, and he, like you said,
he changes.
His,
I mean,
he has grown in this particular film,
absolutely,
because they did give him more to do, obviously. And then when the scene where he's explaining what happened, and Katniss couldn't explain, but he was the one who actually helped save people and get people out of his capital or his district.
Right.
Like, I liked how they gave him more, like, yes, he is a leader. He is here to fight. He's part of this whole thing as well from the beginning. Yeah. So I loved how they're growing his character. Also, I was just questioning they're in District 13 right now, but they're from District 12, which are known for mining. He's a miner.
Right.
And then seeing him in District 13 all in get up and very military.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, where did this come from? I know he's a hunter, but he was very military-like.
Yeah, he was. And again, I think it just goes
Gale's
back.
He's a survivor.
He's a survivor. He's, the one. Well, he adapts, but he makes a conscious decision, and he's like, this is the right thing to do. We're doing this. There's a purpose for this, and I'm going to be part of this, and I will grow into being leader. And, I like that they gave him more. But in all hindsight, when I thought about the books and everything, to me, Gale is the strongest character. He stands by his convictions, and not in a bad way. So there is one thing I wanted to bring up to the team. Am I the only one? So they strafe in carpet bomb District 12. I mean, they turn it into rubble, but this one house... Like, we're across the street, it's all rubble, and she walks in, there's not even a piece of china out of place.
I thought it was very convenient that the Victor's Village half of the Victor's Village actually did get plumbage, but her particular house, the Victor's Village, was still okay.
Oh, yeah. See, I took that as a total, like, this was President Snow speaking to her.
I get it, and there are smart bombs. I've never seen smart bombs that smart. Like, we're literally across the street. Like, we've had tumblers here. We've had, like, minor earthquakes here that have knocked things off of a shelf. Like, all the china. Like, she walks in, and I'm, like, going...
Nothing's
Nothing was, like, out of place, except for the old roses and the one right rose. And I get it. It's President Snow, but that's called precision.
Maybe he put all the china back. Yeah. Maybe he came in, and he felt bad about everything on the floor, so he fixed it and bought her new china.
That explains
it. So it wouldn't be touched at all.
That's it.
That's a great insurance plan.
It's awesome.
But, the idea.
I do like how the movie, how they're portraying the white roses. Because white, we know, that's a very symbolic color for, like, purity and good. But friendship. The way that they're using it for white is really bad. Every time we see the white rose, we're like... Ooh, okay, President Snow. It has a negative connotation.
It contradicts what a white rose
should be.
See, I don't know if I can agree with you on this.
Wasn't this in the book, though?
Yes, the flowers are on the book, except for, like, when they're all scattered across the crater from the bomb, they are red roses.
I don't know.
But
some florists made a killing.
No, they were white roses.
No,
they
not
only
in the
had
book.
two dozen. They only had two dozen.
Not in the
roses.
Book, though. In the book, in the crater, the roses are pink and red.
Are they pink and red?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they were white.
I believe you, though.
They're the pink and red, because she references that those are the same color the roses were. She references that those were the same colors the roses were when her and Peeta were on the stage, and they were supposed to be their roses for lovers.
Okay.
And those were supposed to be the ones laid on the ground in the crater. And I actually don't even think they were on the crater. I think they were on the floor of the Justice Building, or by the Justice Building of... 13. So that was a change, but I get symbolically they want to make it a consistent, strong image with the white. I agree with that choice. At this point, I kind of wanted to hear some verbalization of what those roses really mean or were symbolizing or were in reference to, because In the book, it's just we hear so much more about how these are actually affecting cats, and I see that they're affecting her, but at this point, we've seen this image so many times that I want a little bit more explanation out loud so that other people can understand what these roses mean to her. And that it's waiting too long.
Should we just leave it at a rose by any other name?
I guess.
We should. Okay, yeah, you are right. Fresh pink and red
You
roses.
Know what I'm more impressed
Long stem pink and red beauties, the very flowers that decorated the sets were painted in.
All right. Form. Well, kudos to the both of you. Kudos to you for remembering. Kudos to you for going right to the freaking page and finding it. Wow. That's great.
That's really good. yes, but okay. So a very interesting visual symbolization of such small inanimate objects.
And I got it. And we'll see if it comes into play a little bit.
The costuming was also great. I thought they did a really nice job of her Mockingjay costume.
There really wasn't a lot of costume design in jumpsuits, which really, I mean, those gray and blue and jumpsuits, it really felt like
What are you talking about? Did you see Effie? Effie did prison. Did work on her uniform.
For her hair.
Well, at least there was no, like, fiery dresses or any of that stuff.
But the fact that, like, everyone is now visually kind of on the same level, that even Katniss is wearing jumpsuits and whatnot, she's not higher or lower than anyone, really.
No, except for when she puts on her cool bodysuit that has, like, wings on the back.
Yeah, and that she's, you know, becoming more militaristic, you know, because those are military efficiency kind of suits that allow the, you know, you can tell, allow mobility and
they're
whatnot.
Durable.
And then even when she's in the field, she's all in black.
And when you don't, you can throw them in the wash. They don't need dry cleaning.
It looks very comfortable. It's a fact. But also going in contrast to that, we had the Capitol and their white, all white outfits. PETA's, the first time we see PETA, he's in a big white suit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Usually they did a really good job with him. He looked, as we saw more and more from him, he looked more and more tortured. There was a point where I was like, how is his neck fitting in that collar? I don't know if this was a special effect or
an
act.
Yeah, they were, because it was funny. It brought up discussion, and he's like, nah, I didn't go on any diet. They used a lot of CG. His face.
Because he got very...
Very thin.
Tight neck.
Yeah. But also, again, the use of white not being pure and good.
Sure.
Being very evil.
Yeah.
I like that. And then even at the end, the very end scene, when we have extracted Peter and he's back and he's in his restraints, he's in an all-white room.
The padded walls,
He's in an all-white room. Yeah. Out of all the places we've already seen in District 13, that is the whitest room out of all of them.
Yeah, it was pretty white. Yeah,
yeah, which it shows. It also like just shows that the Capitol is still influencing him at District 13.
Can I ask you folks a question regarding that scene?
Yeah,
Tell me. Okay, when you saw it, I know you didn't see it opening weekend, but was your theater crowded nonetheless when you went to go see it?
Not extremely. There were people, but I wouldn't say crowded.
Okay, how about you?
I was pretty crowded at night. I actually have a funny story.
Okay,
funny, not so funny for me. When I was so excited to see this film that I went into the wrong theater screening room.
Oh no!
The first time, so I sat down, and then there it's literally near the end of the film. I'm like, "What's going on? Did the movie start and whatnot?" And then, like me having already read the book, I'm like, "This is in the middle of the book." And then I asked the guy next to me. He's like, no, the movie's almost over. I was like, oh, crap. And I had to walk out and go to the next screening room, like 10, 15 feet
Did you miss the beginning?
No. I was actually on time for mine. But I went into the wrong screening room. I'm like, so a little bit kind of already ruined for me when I went to go see
it. That's funny.
But yes, to answer your question, it was fairly packed. Okay.
The two endings. So, all right. So there's the scene before the one that you were just talking about, the padded room. Mm-hmm. There's the scene where Katniss is reunited with PETA, and he just goes batshit crazy and he violently attacks her, and then he gets taken out with a fire
with a chair or an extinguisher.
Taken out. And then the screen goes to black. Okay. Now, in the theater that I was in, everybody started to applaud. And I was like, why are you applauding? Because A, that was, are you applauding because you think the movie's over? Mm-hmm. B, that was a pretty violent scene that Katniss just like, she just like almost died. So like, why would you applaud that?
Her eyes were
scary. Yeah. Oh my God.
Bloodshot.
Her makeup. But then and it stayed black for longer than a little longer than usual.
An extra beat to it.
An extra beat. And then it opened up to the other scene. So when it went to black, did your audience applause at all?
My audience freaked out. There was a row of girls in front of me, and they're like, what? Is the movie over? Like, literally yelling out loud.
But they didn't
everyone
applaud.
They didn't hear. They freaked out thinking that that was the end of the movie. And I was like, if that was the cliffhanger, I would have been okay with that, because that's how, in the book, that's how the chapter ends.
Right.
And then, because in the film, they pretty much covered the first two pages of chapter 13. And then they didn't even finish the chapter in the book, if you're going by the book stands, for the movie to add another scene after the whole knocking out. It's okay. It leads up to another cliffhanger.
Yeah, the final scene that we get, and I understand, because, again, we're seeing Coin. She's giving her speech. And then we see Katniss. But, again, to me, it seemed superfluous. It seemed tagged on. It seemed like you're making this longer. Then, like, I actually thought it ended, and I was like, going, okay, I get it. We had an incomplete movie anyways. But, you know, and then she walks up, and he's all tied down.
I didn't really need the rest, the second ending, as you've labeled it. But by the time we got there, I saw this movie after I had seen Lorde's AMA performance, in which she sings her Hunger Games song. Mm-hmm. And that's what I ended up thinking about.
Because
in her performance, she starts in a white boxed room, and she's wearing white, and she's like dancing and throwing her hair, but it's more like thrashing around. So when I saw PETA, I was like, this visually feels familiar to Lorde's performance. Yes,
that
where
was
it was like the very similar white walled in rooms and the thrashing. And then, of course, the song starts playing at the end. And it also, I was like, for me, it was just a visual reference to what something I'd already seen. Yeah. So almost Lorde's performance gave away the ending for me. So that's kind of what I was thinking about. Versus, this shouldn't be included.
Well, and again, I ask out of curiosity if people applauded when it went to black. Because, okay.
I will say, in my screening, when they showed the peace signal with the three fingers, there was a whole row of people that did it too. Right in front of me. I'm like, lower your hand.
I do that, I do this in a Star Trek movie. People go, nerd! Geek! but you can get away with that in Mockingjay? I don't think so.
But they did do the peace sign, which I didn't mind. I mean,
the Mockingjay
sign. Well, they have to.
Anything that the way I look at that sort of stuff is, it just makes going to the movies more exciting. And this is like when
people
you're in a crowd.
Engaged.
Well, yeah, people are engaged, but I'm going to just go to the movie going experience. That you're not going to get that in your couch. You're not going to get that at home. You can do it by yourself, but then you're going to go, what am I doing? If you're doing it in a movie theater, like, that's cool. Like, because people are engaged, and it's a bunch of strangers, more or less, who are together for this common experience. And if people are, like, geeking out that way, I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And, I mean, I was really excited for this film, and I think their marketing was amazing, especially for their teasers that they released earlier in the 2004 year.
Which weren't in the movie?
2014.
Oh my goodness. But because like in reverse, it was propaganda for marketing this film.
Right.
And the first teaser was President Snow addressing the Capitol. And then the second one was President Snow, Joanna, and PETA also addressing the Capitol, but being unified. And they were very propaganda-like. And even the posters, we talked about it earlier, before we went on live, that the posters that they used for promotional were propaganda-like.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a guy holding a tire. I don't know what the hell that had to do with anything.
I mean,
I don't know.
It showed,
each
person from a district. But the propaganda of the President Snow addressing...
Which I thought would have been more useful, actually, in the movie. I expected to see more of that in the film, and there wasn't. So it was just, I don't know.
For me, I mean, it's a huge budget movie. Everyone's, so many people were talking about it. It brought in, what, 123 million?
21.
121 opening weekend. The lowest out of
like,
the three.
I knew it was coming. They didn't, I wasn't like, oh, there's a ton of marketing, or there's not as much as I expected. It was there. I wasn't really paying attention to it because I was going to see the movie anyway.
Yeah, to me, the best image that they had was of Jennifer Lawrence's Katniss and that behind her, and she had the wings and the suit. Like that,
the Mack and Jay symbol.
That's the image you need.
But I mean, yeah, it didn't, there was nothing like that I was like, oh, well, that was a really good trailer, or this is a really good strategy. But it also was, I knew it was there. It wasn't like certain other movies that have come out this year where I was like, oh, you came out of nowhere. Where's your marketing been? Right. This one, I knew it was coming. Right. I felt like everyone else did too. Yeah. And they got people in the seats for opening weekend.
And we should talk, we should talk too. Okay, so the release date, November 21st, it was distributed by Lionsgate. They've had all of them. The production budget on this, now this is just, From what I've learned, is estimated around 125. That's just the mere production, which isn't bad. And then their total budget, including the hard drives and advertising that we just talked about. Now this is interesting: 180 million. So we're talking close to 55. Is my math right? 55 million, right? Which for Lionsgate, that's a lot of money.
Yeah,
because I worked there for a long time. 55 mil is a lot of money to put into the hard drives and advertising. Now, another thing that we should note, too, is that this is the first Hunger Games movie that was not showcased in IMAX. It wasn't filmed in IMAX. It did not screen in your traditional IMAX screen.
We believe that was too interstellar. The IMAX experience.
Mm-hmm. But it was in other prestige, large format theaters. But, you know, it's just interesting, and they're not going to do it for the next one either. So, but it's still interesting.
I don't think they should either, because the first part one wasn't, then why should part two be?
Yeah, oh no, I agree for continuity. Yeah. But I will say that Catching Fire looked great in IMAX.
And I will say that they probably lost some money, but
not a whole lot,
and not as much as they're making by making it into two films.
Where they're going to lose the money in IMAX will most likely be in China. But in any case, so it did 121 mil. And I've been having conversations about this, and I wonder a couple of things. Are we finally seeing the young adult bubble coming close to bursting? Or B, was it people didn't like this book to begin with, and they know it's two parts, and they know that they're being strung along? Like, are they not... Did they not go because of that? By not go, I'm saying $121 million went to it, but not 150 plus like the first and second one did.
I think it might be a mix, because everyone that I know who have read Mockingjay, not a lot of times I get a positive review back.
Right.
And I will say I enjoyed Mockingjay, the book, fairly itself, but it's not my favorite book of the series.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still, as a general fan of the franchise, I'm still going to watch the films,
right,
part one and part two. It might just be the car ride, but it's you know, from getting from point A to point B.
Right.
But it's still the journey and how going somewhere, it's leading up to something.
I have two theories. One of mine is on par with you, Dimitri, where, you know, people don't like being dragged around for two movies. They also don't like being dragged around for two movies that aren't getting that great of reviews. Some people are giving this way lower on Rotten Tomatoes. Do you really want to go out and see it when you know it's going to be bad? But I can't make a full judgment until we get through the holiday weekend, because a lot of people save movie going for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, but again, here's what's going to happen this weekend. It's the audience is going to be fragmented by a ton. And regardless of whether you're reporting a 3-day, a 5-day, you have Penguins coming out, so families, you've got Horrible Bosses, so that's rated R comedy, so you'll have the adults going to that. That one, the gross is on its opening night, we're pretty good. So it's the first time that they're going to be facing any sense of like some competition where fragmenting an audience is going to happen to them. Now, that's not saying that they won't be number one again coming into their second weekend. They got a 66% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's
only
just
66.
Yeah, only 66. It's just very interesting that, you know, and perhaps, too, this splitting the movies, people are getting tired of this. Now, I'm over it.
I am over it as well. After Harry Potter, Twilight, and now the Divergent series is doing it again because Mockingjay did it. It's just the new trend.
Well, and let's take this back, because I don't want to feel like I'm picking necessarily on Lionsgate, even though Mockingjay should have been one movie. I get why they did it, because Warner Brothers did it with Deathly Hallows. And when Deathly Hallows, they did it, I felt, my first thought was, oh, Jesus, they're separating this out. But Deathly Hallows is 12 to 1,400 pages.
I know. I was like, long. Read the book. They had to split that into.
If you were going to do it right. And I think for the most part, and I was checking the reviews, Deathly Hallows Part 1 has done at least 10 percentage points higher than Mockingjay. I think they did a good job, and I understood it. And then Twilight did it. And you're like, really? Does a Twilight book need to be
and
done
And that's
that
when
way?
I felt that was just for the money.
Right.
That
and
was
then
the
this
studio's
one
influence.
Felt for the money. But I'm going to go back to, you know, the ultimate sin goes to back to the people who have started this all. Warner Brothers, who I've been very kind to. I've always said that they've done great job marketing and things like that. But now they've come back in The Hobbit. three movies for the shortest book, so I can complain about Mockingjay being two, but three movies for
that's
one
a stretch.
Book that's a stretch
that's such
you
a stretch.
Stretched us out for 3 years.
Like, I don't need to see a kitchen scene for 20 minutes.
Right. And again you
but
know
that's Lord of
granted
the Rings.
They've given us scenes that we haven't seen, like, you know, a butterfly saving Gandalf. Oh wait, no, we have seen this before.
Yeah,
so it's just like, you know, I get it. They're trying to sustain franchises. Well, why don't you just come up with new movies?
And they're starting just trying to be relevant. Movies. And also, Harry Potter had such a following. They had a 10-year following already leading
That's
up to
true.
The two parts. And then Mockingjay has only, and Hunger Games have only been out since 2008. So
Is it
we've
2008?
Only, the first book was published in 2008. So we've only had 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and so I just, you know, this trend, and you're right, Divergent, I haven't read any of those
so
books.
So this is where I feel like the just money involved.
Yeah. And I felt
but
it.
They're all
one.
In consensus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Sarah, you mentioned Lord a little bit. Let's talk about just a bit of the bad of the music. Just a little bit.
Okay.
Are we going to Lord soundtrack or the soundtrack used in the film?
Well, since we already mentioned Lord, let's talk about Lord first. She had a original song for this film, and she also helped curate the soundtrack, which I'm not sure. Are you two big Lord fans, Lord listeners?
I've always liked Lord. I heard about her quite a while ago. I remember she sparked my interest because I heard she was from New Zealand, and it was like right after I got back from New Zealand, so I was like, oh, cool. I really like her. Some of her stuff at this point has been so played so much that I can't enjoy it as much anymore, which is sad because I really did enjoy it when it first came out.
Royals.
But I mean, for this song, the main one being Yellow Flicker Beat, I've really enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching her performance of it recently, and I think that, you know, she made a very dark her song that fit the film well. I have not can't say I've listened to the her full soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of glimmered through it, and you know, she picks some more, I guess, kind of like on the verge artists or obscure. I think that she has a great style, and I think it was a good ploy for them to use her as a
pawn to get more money. And I got nothing against Lord. You know, she's fine. I think she's. What is she, 17?
She's so young.
Yeah. She's young.
I mean, does anybody
she's
know for
teenager.
Sure?
She's a teenager. She's a
teenager. It's
But to curate a whole soundtrack for
no,
a humongous
it's given,
film.
That's a big responsibility. I was going to go back to the actual score of the film. I mean,
James Newton Howard. Back again.
He's done so much. I mean, just recently. I mean, we had Maleficent, Nightcrawler. I believe he did Catching Fire. I forget if he did the first
Hunger
Games. Yeah,
he did first and second.
So, you know, he's a very prolific composer. Mm-hmm. I think that his music did, you know, it was effective in helping the pace of the movie. You know, and again, when you're hiring a guy like this, I mean, this is a guy who's been around for a little while and has over 100 movies under his belt as far as a composer goes. Yeah, the music was fine.
I always enjoyed the cinema, the orchestra.
You always aspect have. I remember our conversation and Catching Fire.
I enjoyed the orchestral theme songs more so than actual singing in the words, because music itself and the instrumental part makes me emote more than having someone sing the words to me. This is how I'm supposed to feel. Mm-hmm. So having that kind of music, I can make my own decisions of what I'm feeling, which I always enjoy a lot more.
Yeah, and the tech specs in this movie I thought were fine. Joe Willems, as the cinematographer, did a really good job, and he did a great job contrasting exterior and interior and looking at whether... You know, looking at drab or making brown colors, and then the scene with Gail and Katniss outside. Again, very lush, very beautiful outside. And then when you compare it to other districts, which weren't as lush and colorful, I thought cinematography wise, shots were composed very well.
Only real moment in the film that I was consciously aware that the music was there was when they were just burned the hospital down. And then there's like her and her whole speech towards the camera. If we burn with you. I can hear the music underneath it.
Visually, going back to what you said, I also think that he did really do some great dynamics between exterior shots. Going back to the very wide we get of that dam, to the trees, to above the trees, below the trees, hunting with the deer by the stream, by the river, all of those scenes I thought were very beautiful. And then on top of that, I think 13, the detail and production design, they at least they gave it character. For instance, I liked the triangle staircase all the way down.
That was amazing. Yeah. I love the shot.
Yeah, I liked how they stacked that. I thought that was visually interesting, like all the different angles they used on it. Also, you know, just making it can be so drab if everything's covered in cement and dark.
Sure.
And they did give them like their living quarters, their different areas did have a different vibe. The only thing that they missed for me production-wise was we didn't get the meadow downstairs, Beatty's Hummingbird Meadow, but I think that was just because they really did want to make outside feel very important and very different, and if you gave them a meadow internally, it wouldn't make that jump to be able to go outstairs as impactful. So that was the only thing that I was kind of wishing I had gotten to see that I didn't, but other than that, visually, weapons room's great, hovercraft's great, loved them.
The special effects for me were a little hit and miss. I thought in some scenes they worked.
I really liked the hovercraft.
The hovercraft was okay, but like the scene, the bombing of the hospital. To paraphrase a friend, it reminded me of the original Richard Hatch, Dirk Benedict, Battlestar Galactica. If you see the pilot and watch the bombing of Caprica, I was like, oh, this is what this is sort of looking like. And there was another scene where a ship was going through the lushness of, I forget over what district, and I could sort of kind of tell, like, okay, it's just the camera panning this way, and they threw something in that tried to look shiny.
But the capital is influence in sending more.
No, but there are other scenes in which, and again, it was just odd to where they chose to throw their money at. To me, like, because some scenes you can tell, oh, okay, they're putting all their money into this shot to make it look great, and it does. And then in other scenes, well, we're going to be economical here. We have to save money here so we can get the big shot.
So we have the second film to go through.
Right, and we still have
where the main budget's going to, is storming the capital.
It's interesting because they did, it'd be curious to know, budgetary-wise, I know that we broke it down, but they filmed it as one... kind of movie with the ideas to where they're going to break. Yeah,
principal filming is done.
Yeah, they're all done. So they've got a year to put this film together. If this second film doesn't look good.
Yeah, quick question. Do you think it would be better waiting another full year, or should they release it in the summer?
Summer is packed, and I think they're afraid to go up against... Avengers Fast and Furious all in April. Marvel like, movies. Where are you going to open up this year? And you're getting like a lot of you're getting Jurassic World. You're getting a lot of movies. So picking it back in November, what their big competition is going to be is Star Wars. And that breaks,
for next year, yeah, 2015, and that
3 to 4 weeks after they're going to open up on Thanksgiving again. You know, I wish that they would, like, you know, they're making everybody wait a year. It seems irony.
I only ask that because for Harry Potter, they released part one in November and then the second part in the summer.
And I think it's a stronger franchise.
Audience didn't have to wait a full year.
Yeah, I just think it was a stronger franchise.
We have another year to wait. I'm still excited.
I just say it's ironic because Lionsgate is playing the part of the Capitol. And you know, with their greed and going for this and making us wait a year, the audience has to suffer through, you know. But they're not going to suffer through. I think next year they're going to see a ton of great movies.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of like, oh, well, great. I'll wait for you to finish what you've started. Thanks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of well, thanks for making you me saw wait. Me see one, so I'm going to see two.
Right.
And I think,
but I'm not like, yes.
Yeah.
Two is going to be amazing.
I think part two will have a better opening weekend as well. So.
Perhaps. I'm excited. I mean, I haven't seen that.
People aren't broke
future,
from all the other films.
I think that, it just stands to reason because when people know it's your last thing in the series, sometimes you end up getting people who never saw a Hunger Games movie. Because of the hype, they'll go, oh, it's the last one. It's like the final episode of any television series. Mm-hmm. People might have never watched that series, but they hear it's the last one and they got to see it for whatever reason. And then they'll comment and say it sucked because they have.
I didn't understand what any of this meant.
I'm excited for it. I really am. Knowing what's to come from the book and what's to come in the movie, and what's to come of all the characters, it's going to be fun.
I'm going to. It's going to be interesting.
Last quick let's.
Let's see it.
You enjoyed it?
Yeah. You know what? I like this franchise. I liked Jennifer Lawrence. I liked a lot of the actors in it. Better than I expected. Not my favorite movie of the year. Not my favorite movie of the franchise. But a good movie that will keep it alive until we get the last film.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll just reiterate. I felt that it was a setup. It was a two-hour setup for the next movie. It felt that way. It felt obvious. It felt a little bloated. There were some, you know, I do give them credit for reworking and rewriting in scenes and getting out of this internalist and trying to make it more external. They had a Herculean task in adapting that book. I think there were many parts in which they succeeded, but ultimately it's just the setup for the next movie.
Definitely set up. But, you know, it's the journey that counts. It's the journey that...
Forever our optimist.
But that's why I love her. I don't disagree. She's right for that point.
But getting there is half the fun. So
sure.
I love the books. I love the film. I love our show. In the meantime, to keep talking about Mockingjay, where can people follow you?
Well, DMovies at DMovies1701. Mock away.
And Sarah, you do not have a Twitter.
Nope. But I'm here on the Popcorn Talk Network.
There we go.
So just keep tuning into the shows, guys.
Yes, and if you haven't already, please subscribe to Popcorn Talk Network on iTunes and on YouTube. Check out Popcorn Talk Network. You can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. You can follow all of us here talking about more dissections in the future. More Mockingjay to come.
Yeah, and can I say, come on to Popcorn Talk Network. It looks awesome.
It's amazing.
Whether you go to YouTube and put in Popcorn Talk, the YouTube Popcorn Talk channel is fantastic. Yes. Everything at your fingertips. The website is awesome, too. Check it out.
If you love movies,
24/7.
That is the place
it's
to
great.
Go.
Great.
All right. Thank you, guys. And we will see you for Mockingjay Part 2.
Well, hopefully we'll see you before that.
Yes.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.